rise. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Ross, Judge Johnson, the Honorable Randall.
Good morning. You may be seated. And welcome to the Court of Appeals and live. It's nice to be live here in courtroom 200. And I'll note that the counsel for appellant, you've used the middle podium, and that's well and good. In fact, it's preferable in the sense that you got the clock right in front of you and you can raise it and lower it as needed. We do have the alternative podiums in the event you're uncomfortable with the distance. You're the same distance from us, largely, I think, but at least from each other, you have that choice. So I'll note for the record this first matter, A220100, Vi Bang petitioner appellant, Ka Tao respondent. And so, counsel for appellant, if you would identify yourself for our record, please, then you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Der Yang, and I'm here for the appellant husband. I'm Ai Vang. Your Honors, I'm not asking this court to recognize a cultural marriage.
Ms. Yang, if you don't mind, maybe pull your microphone down a little bit.
Is this better?
I think it's a little better, yeah.
Thank you. I'm not asking this court to recognize a cultural marriage. I'm not asking this court to find my client a putative spouse. I'm not asking this court to find that this is an immigration-recognized marriage, therefore, Minnesota should as well. I'm not asking this court, as the respondent wife has put forth, to require Thailand to recognize a cultural marriage. What I am asking this court to do is to recognize a refugee marriage. That is a marriage that took place in a refugee camp in a host country.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Yes.
When I look back at the law, this term place shows up. And I tried to dig down and see how far back I can go. And it goes a very long way back. Are you aware of any case where our court or some other court using that verbiage has defined what place means?
Your Honor, I have not been able to find any cases in this state or in any other state defining a place. I know that in Minnesota we've defined it as a country.
Or state, depending on the circumstance.
Yes, a country or a state. But this is an old case. And when this case came to be, it was before the movement of refugees.
Well, were you able to find any case anywhere, certainly not in Minnesota, but anywhere in the country, where a refugee camp was considered the legal authority, or the authorities in the camp were substituted for civil authorities for the purpose of establishing a legal marriage?
Your Honor, I have not been able to find such a case. However, there is a case, Vo, that I cited in my brief. In Vo, a man was born in a refugee camp. Because refugee camps do not issue birth, death, marriage, or divorce certificates, he was unable to obtain a birth certificate. He went to register to get married, and he was unable to because he was not able to produce a birth certificate because none was ever issued to him in a refugee camp. In that particular case, the court decided that because it was an impossibility, the court was going to put an injunction on the local authorities' rule requiring a birth certificate to obtain a marriage license and allowed him to obtain a marriage license. I think that my case is very similar to that. The main crux of the argument from the wife is that my client is unable to produce a marriage certificate. It is an impossibility for my client to obtain a marriage certificate because he was a refugee in a camp. He was not allowed to leave the camp. He was not allowed to access the host country's civil system.
Now, the respondent points out that these are factual assertions that aren't attached to citation in the record, that these are, that's a theory, but without record support.
Your Honor, I do not believe that testimony from my client is necessary. The law of the country, specifically the Immigration Act of 1979, that is public, that is accessible by anyone in the world, states that refugees are considered illegal immigrants. They're not allowed to work. They're not allowed to access the civil system. They're not allowed to access any kind of support from the host country. I do not believe that a client should just state, well, you know, I'm not allowed to do that. It's common knowledge because it's the law of that country. And the law says explicitly that refugees are illegal immigrants and not allowed to work there, to marry there. Well, not marry, but rather to access the civil registry system there.
Ms. Yang, am I correct? Under international law, well, perhaps it's not internationally recognized, but a country that accepts those from another country into a refugee camp are subject to the laws of that country.
Well, Your Honor, the people living in the camps are subject to the laws. However, those—
Wouldn't that include marriage? And that was the point in our court's Yang decision, which I assume from your argument today you don't find persuasive and suggest we don't find persuasive. But then the Ma decision as well, which refers also again to place. But if that place is in a country which you're subject to the laws, and we can, I assume, safely assume a refugee camp is not its own sovereign country, aren't we left with the only place left is the country within which that refugee camp is located?
Well, Your Honor, that's the case if there is if the host country has immigration laws that define their authority. In the case of Thailand, the only law that they promulgated in response to the refugees fleeing into their borders was the 1979 Immigration Act. There are no other laws in Thailand that speak to the immigrants. The Thai government, if refugees leave the refugee camps and commit a crime, would punish the refugees according to their laws. If they commit a crime in the camps, they have the authority to also punish the individual, but they don't. That's a punishment and not a right bestowed upon the refugees.
When you say they have the right to punish, you mean
the government?
The government of the place where the
yes.
camp is.
Yes, they have that authority to punish, but they do not grant those same, they do not grant rights or privileges to refugees as they would their own citizens.
Does the UN have a set of rules or laws or regulations, whatever you want to call them, that govern a refugee camp such as this one? And I guess, and then secondarily, is that in the record? But go ahead and answer to the best of your knowledge without regard for the record for the moment.
Yes, thank you for your question. So in the 1951 Convention on Refugees and its protocols set out specific rules for receiving countries. The United States is a signatory to those protocols. And what they say is you can designate an entity or an authority to these refugee camps. And that entity makes rules for the people that you are going to receive to your country. In our case, we designated the INS, now DHS. we gave them, through the Immigration and Nationality Act, powers to establish familial relationships. We gave them powers to establish birth dates.
Can I stop you for a minute? I guess I'm wondering whether at the refugee camp, you know, within the boundaries of Thailand, whether there is some arrangement between Thailand and the UN, if the UN is the responsible entity who is organizing that camp, whether the UN has some set of rules or laws that govern conduct on the camp, or that you know, kind of maybe almost whether there's any kind of informal government that is established by the UN that, you know, to which the country of Thailand might yield. Is there any such thing?
I believe that there is a contract between the United Nations and the host country. Each refugee camp, depending on the nature and the population, has their own unique rules on conduct, on various other qualifications for programs. And for this particular case, this is a smaller camp in northern Thailand and not the main camp, which is Ban Vinai, which is the largest camp in Thailand. And so I'm not familiar with the specific contract between the United Nations and Thailand for that particular camp.
Do these contracts ordinarily have rules and regulations that bear on civil relationships or that create structures similar to laws?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of that.
And it's not in the record one way or the other.
No.
You know, I was curious as I was reading your brief, because I've had a number of cases involving the putative spouse statutes. When I read your brief and I saw a number of assertions about what one party believed or the other believed about whether a marriage existed, I thought this was going to venture into, okay, putative spouse, I've seen this before. I didn't see it develop that way, and I gather when I did further reading that wasn't put at issue. I'm just curious as to, I'm assuming there's a reason why the putative spouse approach wasn't taken.
Your Honor, the putative spouse and the way that it came through in this state is for an innocent party who thought they were married but found out later on through some kind of a mistake that they weren't married. And so the putative spouse is put in to make that person whole in a way. In this particular case, it's not like that.
I thought that was kind of your argument, that she thought she was in a legal marriage, and lo and behold, you know, when they went through this cultural divorce process, that's when they learned that that's when she learned there was no legal marriage. It seemed like it was on all fours with the putative spouse badge. I mean, you don't have to spend a lot of time on it because it's not an issue, but I was just curious because it seems like that was your argument. If I'm correct, and you've acknowledged that the putative spouse statute is not at issue, would you agree then with opposing counsel that what the parties believed about the legality of the marriage just doesn't matter?
Your Honor, for my argument, I do believe that it does matter to the extent that to them and to the camp officials, who were the officials at that time, their marriage was legal. It was legal when they crossed the borders into the United States.
But how does their subjective intent bear on whether it was a legal marriage? Or not their intent. How does their subjective knowledge about the existence of the legality of a marriage bear on the issues that you've raised on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, it goes to my first issue, which is that the district court shifted the burden, and that the burden should have laid with the respondent wife. So from my perspective, our
Talk me through that. Help me understand how the belief bears upon the burden shifting.
Well, first of all, my client has put forth his subjective belief that they were married. He has put forth the facts that they were together for 24 years, that they have filed all of these official documents as a married couple. The burden of proof should have been on the wife, not to say, well, there's no marriage certificate. She should have been able to, she should have been required to show that they did not live together for 24 years, that he did not believe that they were married, that they didn't file taxes since they've been in the United States as married, a married couple, that they didn't sign papers.
Can you address then the argument that that would essentially backdoor the Minnesota's rejection of common law marriage? If there's a presumption of marriage based upon, even in part, the all of these things, holding out as married, believing you're married, filing taxes together, and so forth, and then those are the things that shift the burden, and the other side says, well, I don't have any other information, it seems like then the court would acknowledge that there is a marriage based upon these subjective feelings and holding out, and essentially make us a common law, return us to a common law marriage state.
Your Honor,
I was going to say, Ms. Yang, feel free to answer Judge Ross's question, even though your time near the end finish. You can finish your answer, and then you'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal as well.
Thank you. That would be the case if these individuals were just regular Minnesotans, meaning they've lived here, they were born here, or that they came here and they had the option to go into a courthouse and get married or in front of some authorized individual to get married. That's not the situation here.
Well, they did after they arrived.
Well, they had the belief that they were married. And in so much as, you know, to go back to your question about the putative spouse, if there were to, because part of the putative spouse scheme is that there has to be somebody who was somewhat ill-intentioned and they were trying to, like, deceive this other person. If there were a deceptor in this situation, it would be the United States government. It would be the INS. Because on every legal document, they were written down as married.
Very well, and you will have 5 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for a respondent, you may approach, and before you begin, if you'd identify your name
sure.
for the record and who you represent.
Definitely. May it please the court, learned counsel, your honors. My name is Shia Lo, it's spelled S-I-A-L-O, on behalf of the respondent. Contrary to appellant's argument, we are talking about whether or not this marriage is legal. This marriage took place in Thailand. It must comply with Thai law, whether it's in a refugee camp or in a village.
Well, it also took place in the refugee camp, and I'll just begin my questions to you the same
yes.
as I began with Ms. Yang. I was struck by your briefs, unless I missed it. I mean, there's a significant argument that place doesn't necessarily mean country. In this case, you have some structure, some community within a country. It's a refugee camp, and the argument is that place can mean refugee camp. I didn't see a response in your argument going into the meaning of the word place and helping me to understand. Maybe the argument has merit.
Yeah.
Were you not able to find any basis for an argument against the UN being the place?
That is correct, Your Honor. We have not been able to find a place representing a refugee camp and not a state or a country.
Right. I mean, your brief didn't mention. I mean, there's the argument is, though, that the word place in the statute, I mean, if you look at it, there's not really a statutory term.
Right.
It just sort of shows up as far back as I can go. I think it was 1910. In Minnesota, citing an Iowa case, and you kind of keep digging back, and you just find this word that just shows up that judges use. But no court, as far as I can tell, has attempted to say, and this is precisely what we mean by place.
Right.
It means country. It can't mean other things. So why can't the idea of place mean a refugee camp, given the structure, given the different arrangements that go on in the camp and the presumed separate authoritative bodies and regulatory forms in a refugee camp? Why can't that be placed?
It can, Your Honor, but the Minnesota has, that's the place of the state legislature to do that. And
well,
I've not been able to find.
I think it's a judicial term. I've never seen the legislature. The term place is not a, unless I'm wrong, were you able to find it in a statute?
Well, not in the statute, Your Honor, but it's in Ma V. Ma, it talks about the place, and that place is China. In that case, it talks about how someone can get their marriage legally in China, and you have to get a license. It doesn't have to comply with Minnesota regulation, but it need to comply with China regulation. So as in this case, it has to comply with the regulation in Thailand. That is the crux of our argument. The case of control, this case, is Ma v. Ma and Yang v. Fang.
Hypothetically, let's just play this out. Let's assume that there are different regulations. Speaking of China,
yep.
Let's assume that there are regulations in place in Hong Kong that differ from the rest of the nation. And the argument is essentially this: well, you didn't comply. You know, China asserts authority over Hong Kong that's not necessarily recognized. I'm just hypothetical. I have no idea what happens in Hong Kong marriage. Let's assume it's the case, though.
Yes.
Which would be the place if the circumstances were the same, but the marriage occurred in Hong Kong following Hong Kong rules, but without following, assuming there's a difference, the Republic of China's rules for the rest of the country.
Right. Based on current law and case laws and the statute, that we will be able to find a place right now. It's our understanding it has to be a country or a state. So if we wanted to include a refugee camp, the state legislature need to do that. That place is belongs in the lawmaker.
That's what I'm saying. It's not a legislative thing, it seems to me. This is a judicial creation,
right.
The idea of place. So why would we have to defer to the legislature on this point? This point being recognizing that
correct.
UN could be a place.
I think that because this court had already spoken about the place, and what I'm saying is what we've been able to find is that it has to be a country. The case on point is Ma v. Ma. So we can't deviate from that. This court need to follow what Minnesota has determined what willing to recognize as a legal marriage. And so in this case, if Thailand does not recognize that marriage, the parties, it's undisputed, the party.
Did the issue come up in Ma, by the way? Did the court ever expressly say that, well, we have to distinguish, there is an argument that something other than the nation is the place, and then the court discusses it. I didn't see that in
yeah.
Ma.
In Ma, the court talks about we have regulation in the in Minnesota how we would recognize a marriage. And so in looking at whether to recognize that marriage from China, though China's regulation is different than ours, it needs to comply with China in
right,
order
but I'm
to
talking
recognize.
About a different question. In that case, there wasn't disputed. China was the place. My question is, have you found anywhere where there's a dispute as to what exactly, what defines place where there's some
yeah.
internal structure, even if it's not a yeah. formal state or nation?
Your Honor, we've not been able to find anything. Otherwise, our brief would be different. So,
Mr. Look, can I follow up with that?
Sure.
The question, and I'm looking at Ma, and it does seem like there was not a dispute as to the place. They agreed it was China, but the summary does cite from the Lycola case versus Engineered Concrete, 1979, the validity of a marriage normally is determined by the law of the place. So there's that word that we keep hearing,
mm-hmm.
where the marriage is contracted. If valid by that law, the marriage is valid everywhere unless it violates a strong public policy of the domicile of the parties. And then that also, the Lycola case cites the estate of Kincaid, which goes back to 1953. So at a minimum, would it be safe to say that there has never been a definition in a court ruling of place? It happened to be that the place referred to was a country. So in answer to Judge Ross's question, we really don't have affirmative law that is the definition.
Agreed, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's exactly. I mean, I think.
So could a refugee camp, I don't know that that's in our record here, we know it's a cultural marriage. I don't know if that's the same as that, therefore it's accepted and that's the law of that place. But hypothetically, perhaps a refugee camp could set forth
what it considers to be culturally and civilly required to be married within that camp.
It's possible, Your Honor, that a refugee camp could create rules and regulations to certify marriage, and to for the refugee camp itself, the United Nations is in control of that camp to say, yes, we would recognize. There is no evidence to support that, that the refugee camp on this particular case actually have rules and regulation in determining the validity of this marriage.
Does that suggest, since this seems like more most akin to a Rule 12 type of dismissal of that of the dissolution, that that would be a fact issue that would require a remand for evidence?
I don't think so, Your Honor. Based on current law that we have in place, I think both parties were given opportunity to present all evidence. I think the facts are in the records about the validity of this marriage, whether or not appellant has been able to show the trial court that indeed there are rules and regulation within the camp that would have recognized this marriage. That evidence would not show. They were given the opportunity. Remanding this back to the trial court is unnecessary.
That's, I was confused about what the court did here. Can you shed some light? I mean, it feels like it's just a basic dismissal, but then there's discussion of evidence. So it felt more like summary judgment. What did the district court do from your perspective? Was it a dismissal on the pleadings, or was it a conversion to summary judgment?
We submitted an answer in counter to the petition that there is no marriage. And after opposing counsel, they received the counter petition. She filed a summary, a declaratory judgment, bringing a motion for the judge to declare that this is a legal marriage. And so the court sets a motion for both parties to present our evidence to show whether or not Minnesota would recognize this marriage.
Right, but what did the court, when you look at the court's analysis, what's your best interpretation of what the court actually did, despite what it said?
Right.
It felt like a weighing of evidence, or a look at the evidence beyond the pleadings, which makes it seem more like summary judgment, which might call into question the propriety of the court's decision, or was it more of a judgment on the pleadings, which might be problematic too, if it's possible, as you've acknowledged, that there might be some contract out there between the UN and the host country, or some policy that might be discovered through further litigation. What did the district court do, as far as you can tell?
My understanding is that the district court need to make a decision whether or not there is a legal marriage that Minnesota could recognize so that that the party can proceed through divorce. And so she gave both parties an opportunity to present the evidence and to present the case to the court, and then the court made its ruling.
So do you think it was, that's my question. Did the court decide this case as a matter on the pleadings? Did the court treat it like summary judgment and say there's no disputed issue of material fact? Or did the court actually accept the evidence, weigh the evidence, and make a decision? I couldn't tell what the district court was doing. What's your position as to
my position is that the court allowed both parties to submit all of the evidence that we can provide to show whether or not this marriage is legal. That she allowed us to provide affidavits, allow us opportunity to present our case on whether or not there's a marriage that Minnesota can recognize. And both parties did that.
In your view, did appellant properly put evidence in the record?
Yes. I mean, whatever she's been able to put everything into the record that the appellant wanted.
And so the I think they were entered as attachments to the memorandum. So your position is that those are part of the record?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And the case was assigned to the family court or the family division of the district court, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
I have a question going back to our discussion about the refugee camp. The appellant's brief talks about the history, and I think I can't remember what your brief said on that. But do you agree that the refugee camp existed in Thailand with the permission of the Thai government? I mean, in other words, it was not a hostile. It was not an adverse relationship, but rather there was cooperation between the Thai government and the UN, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I agree with that completely.
Thank you.
No UN can occupy a piece of land within a sovereign country without that country giving permission.
The appellant asked us to look to beyond the record, but law that exists, so that we could appreciate, based upon the circumstances, that it would be unlawful for the refugees to leave the camp, to go and obtain the license that might otherwise be obtainable. What's the position of, and that the refugees don't have the privileges and immunities that Thailand citizens have. What's your position?
Yeah, we dispute that the Thai did not treat the refugee as a concentration camp. The refugees were able to move in and out of the refugee camp. So that fact is disputed.
Is there evidence in the record one way or the other as to whether...
There is no evidence that appellant was able to show the trial court that the refugee camp prevented the refugees from leaving the camp.
Is it accurate to say that there was no evidence that in the record that they could not leave the camp, and also there was no evidence in the record stating the opposite, that they were free to leave the camp and go pursue a marriage license?
Only through affidavits by outside of defense.
But your client's affidavit was pretty clear on that point.
Yes,
right? That they were free to leave the camp for various reasons and circulate in the Thai community.
And the appellant didn't provide an affidavit in support of their motion. So they're making a lot of argument using facts that is not on the record. Well, thank you so much. I don't have anything to add.
Thank you, counsel. For appellant, you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal, and you may approach.
Thank you, Your Honors. I just want to clarify for this court how this situation shook out. As the court knows, we were required to attend an ICMC. At the ICMC, the respondent wife orally motioned the court to dismiss the pleadings, asserting that there is no legal marriage. The court was prepared to do so at that point, just based on the pleadings. The appellant husband requested that the court at least allow an opportunity to have this looked at thoroughly, and the court allowed a certain number of days, I believe it was like 30 days, for appellant husband to file a memorandum of law. It was highly irregular, and so appellant husband filed the motion and the memorandum of law. The time was very limited, and appellant husband was not afforded the opportunity to do any type of discovery. Appellant husband did request for an evidentiary hearing to at least have this issued fully fleshed out. And that was not allowed by the district court.
So what's your position as to what the district court did? Would the district court decide this on the pleadings, decide it more like summary judgment, or treat the information in the record as submitted as matters of fact for the district court, then freely to weigh and make a decision as to what the facts were?
And, Your Honor, that's the confusion.
But what's your position as to what the district court did?
I believe what the district court did is that they recognized that Minnesota's law hasn't approached.
Let me make it a little procedurally. Which of those three do you think the district court did in this case? Treated this as a matter for decision on the pleadings, which in that case would give the benefit of the doubt to the plaintiff. Did the district court treat it more as summary judgment or more as a fact finding? What exactly does the order do?
Your Honor, I believe what the district court did in some and is to basically treat it like a summary judgment motion. In their finding, they cited specific facts that were attested to by the wife. They cited parts of the memoranda of both sides. And so I believe that they took those and treated this as a summary judgment motion.
Just to be clear, I didn't see in your brief any argument that the district court's procedural approach was an abuse of the district court's discretion. You're not making that argument. You're not challenging the procedure that the district court employed.
No, Your Honor, I did not do that.
I have a question about you earlier said on that point. You earlier said that you requested an evidentiary hearing. The district court denied it. Was that denial on the record? And did you have an opportunity thereafter to submit an affidavit of your client? You did not do so. I'm just wondering if you're making any argument that you did not have an opportunity to do so.
I did not. These arguments occurred at the ICMC hearing, which are not recorded or transcribed in any way. I have made the request for a transcript, but I was told that they don't do transcripts at ICMC hearings. And so the only transcript I was able to obtain was the one of the motion hearing. That's part of the record. But yes, Your Honor, I'm not making that claim today. That I was the procedural issue.
So I'm saying procedurally, if we accepted your premise that it was a summary judgment, which your client now has appealed, would not rather than reverse, as you requested in your conclusion, it would be a reverse and remand for further proceedings because you believe there's genuine issues of material fact, essentially, to apply our civil summary judgment law. What would those fact issues be for the district court to consider this issue of marriage legality?
I think that the place, what the whole conversation we've had today is about the place of the marriage. And I think that's going to be a major issue if we were to have this case fully fleshed out. I think there's an opportunity for us to present evidence of the rules that control that camp at that time.
But if the district court treated this as summary judgment, as you say, then the burden would be on your client to present evidence at the summary judgment stage, already having occurred, that would challenge the district court's, that would create a fact issue. For example, a contract between the UN and Thailand, or some rules and regulations that were employed on the campsite that would indicate some authority for a ceremonial marriage becoming a legal marriage. I mean, I didn't see any evidence of that in the record, and doesn't that challenge your view that a remand would be necessary?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that she treated it as a summary judgment motion. I don't agree that it's the correct way to have treated this issue, but if the court, if this court were to accept that was how the lower court should have treated it, then you're absolutely right. That would put us at a more difficult position. But just to be clear, I don't agree that that's how the lower court should have treated.
But you haven't challenged it. I mean, that's the problem I'm having with the argument. I mean, it sounds like you're asking us to sua sponte, say the court used the wrong process, but it wasn't briefed by either side because it wasn't challenged in the appeal.
Right, and Your Honor, that's why I cited in my brief the rule that allows this court and reviewing courts to set or to do justice, even if the issues were not squarely put before the court. Because this entire case is about justice. We're talking about a country for countryless people. We're talking about rules where at the time these parties married, there were no rules. Just as we have seen with the Syrian refugees, they're jumping out of planes. Nobody has time to go and grab documents. And so I think that this court has the power to make this situation right. And what that situation is to recognize refugee marriages that occur in refugee camps in times of war and distress.
Judge Slater, may I ask one more question?
Yes.
Are you representing that if there were an evidentiary hearing, you would be able to put in evidence of a different set of rules, regulations, laws governing the camp than, you know, that are in conflict with the laws of Thailand?
I will have to do discovery on that. I would have to obtain information from experts abroad, perhaps contact Thai attorneys who have dealt with these issues, and be in touch with the Ministry of Interior, who controlled the refugee camps during these times.
Thanks.
But as we stand here today, you don't have that information, even outside the record.
I do not.
Thank you. Thank you, both counsel. We appreciate your answers to our questions today. And we will be taking the matter under advisement and issue a ruling within 90 days. So you each have a good day.
Thank you.